Okay, push the button.
Done. Today is Sunday, June 21, 2020. This is part 10 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, spelled F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Oh, good, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your willingness to be interviewed for this series. May we have your permission to conduct this interview over the telephone?
You certainly do.
Thank you very much. You had told us this amazing story of rappelling down El Capitan.
I don't think it's that amazing myself. I mean, it's sort of interesting, maybe. But.
Well, I'll put it in this perspective. How many people on the planet do you think have rappelled down El Capitan?
Can you
give me 30? How many people have done this?
Well, actually, probably a fair number, but not at one time like that, you know.
No, just over the entire scope of rope. How many people have rappelled down that thing?
Yeah.
Climbers climb it, and they walk off the top. They don't turn around and rappel back down.
No.
So 30, 40? Do you got a number, roughly?
Oh, well, if you're putting it that way, I would say 15.
Thank you. So, having done something that more astronauts have done.
Oh, come on now.
You know, I mean, yeah, I know, but you put it in perspective. And of course, your answer should be, yeah, but astronauts are smart, and this is not necessarily a smart activity. And that's why so few people have done it.
I thought the reader would understand that.
But no, it's fairly amazing. What else was going on in Yosemite during the 10 years that you were there that we should know about?
Well, one thing I'd like to mention and spend a couple of minutes doing, I feel awkward about doing any of this, really, Tom, as you well know, but once you get me going, I'm fine. But the thing that I'd like to mention is sort of my mismanagement of my marriage. And it goes more or less like this. I got married in 1968 to a wonderful, beautiful woman, but I was so marriage phobic, you know, like a lot of young people are, including young men, that I figured that if once I asked her to marry me and we got married, then what else would she need to know? And I wasn't real good about reinforcing, I love you kinds of stuff. And so having prefaced this, so when I got to Yosemite in particular, and at this point when I got there, we didn't have any kids. So, and she was working, and we both had, separate but together lives. We did a lot of traveling and stuff as well. But along the way, we got so busy for, 5-7 months a year for any number of reasons, shortage of manpower and just wall-to-wall kinds of incidents, some big, some small, but mostly had to be all dealt with. And I felt that I needed to be right in the middle of that for any number of reasons, but partially I was selfish. I wanted to, I liked the adrenaline, I liked the being able to accomplish things. I should say I like helping people, but I think I more enjoyed just the challenge of all the nuances that were taking place on a daily basis, which there were lots and lots. So, and I don't know that we drifted away particularly, but then we had my first boy was born in 1973, and he was stillborn. It was a full-term birth. And, that impacted both of us, but her more than me, just because she was carrying it full term. And I had a whole life that I was living with, trying to get things done and supervising people and trying to manage programs and whatever, that I just wasn't very good about know, being there as a family person. And then my next son, my oldest son, Lincoln, 1975, he, you know, I was a, you know, a father, and I think I was a pretty decent father, but, you know, I don't think I put the priorities where they should have been, which was pay more attention to the family than to the work. And I got suckered into the black hole of, you know, they need me and I need to be doing this, and ended up working a lot of 16-hour days, most of which were never compensated. They just, you know, I had this obligation of trying to help out my fellow Rangers and trying to deal with all the situations that were taking place. And Yosemite, in those days at least, and I'm certainly no whiz-bang on all the other parks, what we're taking on all the other parks, but Yosemite was, it seemed to be on a different level in terms of just workload and interesting, bizarre things that needed to be dealt with. So, you know, along the way, I didn't set my priorities. I ended up working too much, paying too much attention to the job, not enough attention to my wife and my family. I had a second son in 1978, Adam, who teaches and is terribly successful as a teacher in Saudi Arabia right now.
Wow.
Moving to Guatemala, actually, in the next few weeks, if he can get in.
Mm.
And my oldest is a emergency room nurse up in Bellingham, Washington.
Wow.
So, in any event, I the end product is I was actually pretty successful as a father, but during the time leading up to my divorce, you know, I just wasn't there. I wasn't there full time anyway, not like I should have been. And so when I talked to the younger students at the Ranger School, other places, but mostly in the last 20 years, it's been at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. They have two sessions every year with roughly 21, 2, 3 younger people who aspire to get into the National Park Service. And one of the ways of getting in is through being credentialed as a law enforcement ranger. So they have a you know, a very disciplined, long, I think it's like 16 weeks, perhaps even longer, school there at NAU. So, and I end up doing the introduction. For the first 4 hours, I'm the lead speaker, and it's my job to not only talk about the history, but of course I throw in philosophy and ethics and other aspects. And, you know, here I am 35 years with the agency and still have my finger in the pie today. And so I allow, you know, these younger people an opportunity to help answer questions for them and stuff. But mm-hmm. One of the first things I say in the first 30 minutes is start talking about living in a fishbowl. You know, when you're a park ranger in uniform in a marked patrol car, everybody's looking at you from different angles. It's just like being a policeman today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you're driving down the street, you see a policeman, and when he doesn't turn on his turn signals and makes a turn, then there's a little teeny tiny check mark, at least for me anyway, that, you know, that wasn't the right thing to do. So part of that, you know, my pontificating for them is to talk about not paying attention to your family, you know, not setting your priorities right. And then I use myself as an example that at the end of about 9.5 years in Yosemite and then accepting a job at the Grand Canyon, I was kind of oblivious to the fact that, you know, my marriage was going down the tube slowly, but not totally directly, but slowly. And a lot of it had to do with me not paying attention. And I try to at least mention this with some, you know, without trying to shed too many tears, which I often do, that, you know, it was my, not, I'm not going to take the full responsibility, but a lot of it was my fault. And it was just I got caught up with the job. And I don't think in retrospect that, of course, that's easy to do, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, but I don't think I set my priorities properly. Now, things have worked out okay, and both of my sons are, you know, lived through this all very well and have done very well for themselves professionally and personally. But, it took a tremendous toll on me. I didn't realize just how impactful that divorce and, you know, the lessons that I learned from it were going to be to me.
So,
and,
Butch, can I
can I
ask you a question? You remind me about some of the law enforcement rangers that I worked with at Grand Canyon in the 1990s and into the 2000s, who were going from event to event to event. Some traumatic, some there's a cat in the tree, but some are, there's a body splattered all over a cliff. But it was just never ending. And it seemed as though there were always short staffed and people who were in theory on their off time were still working. And that was at Grand Canyon. That wasn't Yosemite.
Yeah. Yeah. I was part of Grand Canyon as well.
To what extent, did you see this happening to other families as well?
Well, I saw it, but, you know, truth is I wasn't smart enough to put it back on myself as well.
Okay.
I think I mentioned early on one of the things that happened for my oldest son was when all this big noise would take place, a jet flame, a flyover, or a lightning or thunderclap or something. You know, and he'd go into hysterics, and my wife finally realized it was because every time he saw his father, meaning me, when a noise would happen, which is generally the helicopter flying in,
right?
I was like in controlled chaos. Of course, I had things under control, but, you know, I was going into my garage, and I was throwing things into a rescue pack or for overnight, and my wife would be handing me two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And then I'd be off, and so he associated that with all this noise. And, of course, we finally got that resolved by taking him over and letting him watch the helicopter when I wasn't on it. And, you know, to see that things were much more civilized or controlled, it wasn't as chaotic as he...
As it seemed.
As
yeah.
I was leading him to believe, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And today... we have help me if I get this wrong. Is it after action debriefing?
Yeah.
To help people deal with the stress, the trauma.
Yeah.
You know, how, not take it personally and not take it home. So I think there are some steps in the right direction. But is it still? Do you still see this as a risk for?
Sure. I mean, it's like in every relationship, you know, it's a compromise. You have to understand your obligations and what's happening in the relationship as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like the antithesis of being a good relationship manager, you know, understanding person. So I'm not going to pontificate about that except to just relate my personal story. And I'm, you know, sort of a living example of not what to do in some cases. Now, in many cases, I was terribly successful. I'm not going to denigrate my contributions either, but, I was, an excellent manager and did some good things, but I did some bad things when it came to my relationship, that's for sure. And it had nothing to do with abuse. It had nothing, well, I guess maybe it does, actually. Maybe it is sort of emotional abuse, you know, I wasn't there.
Yeah, but that's I think that's not unique to the National Park Service.
No,
that can be any partner who devotes their all to the business or the job or, whatever their
you're right. I mean, I agree.
They're wrapped up in, and so a relationship can suffer.
So your question had to do with, or at least you're mentioning the, after action debriefings and, the PTSD kinds of things that they do today. But in my day, it was just part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
You go out on a body recovery, mostly. I mean, there might have been other things that we, got involved with as well that were, in today's climate, maybe should have been addressed. But what we would do is, and some of this I know that I've already mentioned, but I'm not a drinker. I don't like alcohol. I was the one that they'd always come to find for some bad wreck because everybody else had been at a party or something.
Right.
So, and I was willing to do that, and still would be. I mean, that would be perfectly fine. But, we would have these gatherings afterwards, and sometimes there were as not primitive, but as simple as, everybody involved would be sitting on somebody's picnic benches behind their home, talking about it. And they, people be having beers and I'd be having my Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, what was one of the nice things about a community like Yosemite is that the spouses, the wives in this case mostly, would often, know that we'd be off the mountain or the rock or the thing would be over with by a certain time, and they'd have a potluck supper. It wouldn't be very particularly fancy, but it would be more just the camaraderie and the ability to share with each other what's going on and share with our families as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the wives, I don't know so much about a seven-year-old kid, but the wives are always right there in the middle of it, and everybody knew everybody, which is also one of the dangers of living in a place like Yosemite or Grand Canyon. It goes back to this fishbowl
perspective
where, you do know what's going on in somebody's bedroom practically, and you work with these people professionally, socially, you know them very well.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, my time in Yosemite, I lucked out because with very few exceptions, everybody was totally simpatico with each other and empathetic and was very willing to help out and support. And so there was a lot of that. But generally, that's part of my little diatribe to the young people at NAU is, remember, you're in a fishbowl. I mean, everybody's right. Going to be looking at you.
To that end, the Park Service seems unique in that it provides housing for its employees. The Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, you're responsible to find your own housing in the communities adjacent to the areas where you work. But the Park Service often provides housing at their larger parks. And then suddenly, it is a fishbowl because your next door neighbor is the, head of maintenance or some other position, and you can hear there's something going on over there. Instead of, your next door neighbor, works at the engineering facility down the road, and you hear something going on over there, it's a little different.
Yeah. Well, you're mostly correct, Tom. Now make sure that whoever might be reading this or hearing any of this understands, the Park Service didn't give me free housing.
Thank you. I didn't mean free housing, meaning the housing at Yosemite in the valley, you paid for that.
Yeah.
But it came with the job, and so you didn't have to go outside the park
right.
to rent a house somewhere and then commute. So, and that made sense, I think, in the early days, especially 19-teens, 1920s, and 1930s, when these parks were out in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
and they had hospitals and they had schools and they were basically their own towns, generating plants, etc., stores. It was a company town, if you will.
That's mostly correct. I mean, there are nuances and asides to all of what you said, but for a place that's isolated like Yosemite, if you were on sort of like required, that'd be like quote unquote required housing or required position or required occupancy,
mm-hmm.
then the government would furnish you a home commensurate with the size of your family. And the further up the totem pole you were from a management standpoint, maybe a little bit better house. Most of them were 1920, 1930 era log cabins. And then the first home I lived in Yosemite Valley was a Mission 66, which is a program started right after World War II, principally. And then they call it Mission 66 with the idea that a lot of this would be completed by that point. So, but they're all, they're decent homes. But you paid rent, and you paid, but the rent was, and at least for most of the time, was much more minimal. When I lived in Death Valley, I mean, I was like paying $14 every 2 weeks.
Okay.
But it was a CCC home, and I lived 30 miles from the nearest neighbor, except for one neighbor. And I was 60 miles from the nearest grocery store, and I was 100 miles from the nearest medical anything.
So $28 a month is not bad for living in the middle of nowhere.
So, and if you're young and healthy, then that's perfectly fine. And
yes.
I guess if you're old and not healthy, they probably wouldn't put you there to begin with, really.
Right.
But in Yosemite, as you say, we had the little hospital, we had a market, and there were some amenities there. And what's not like about living in Yosemite Valley, except
right.
that after a while, you might want to go to a movie theater, you might want to, have a more than just a minimal grocery store. You might want some department store kinds of stuff. And even though there was a doctor and they were terribly good at what they did, they were limited in what they had to offer.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a part of the operation that people don't understand. And there are places in the Forest Service as well as BLM where this also takes place. There are fairly isolated Forest Service operations, but they are more inclined to be with a city or a town than some of the Park Service areas. And of course, the Park Service does that as well.
Right.
Not everybody that lives in a national park has to live in the park.
There is no housing at the Statue of Liberty, I don't think.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, there's some rangers that live actually on Ellis Island itself.
Okay.
And, there's some uniqueness to that. And, 20 years later, they will look back with their families and say, geez, that was pretty neat.
Right.
Living in New York Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, there is a inconvenience, and you're a captive to that particular spot. And I don't know too much about the operation, really, but I don't think you probably have your own personal boat to get back and forth. You'd have to use the tour boats.
Well, I guess the thing I'm thinking is, if I'm a dispatcher and I know who's living in my park, and I need some help, then I can call you at 2 a.m. That I know you're supposed to be asleep, but too bad, I know you're working day shift. And we need some help.
Yeah.
We're short staffed or whatever, and there's been a terrible incident and everybody's drunk, and so we're gonna come talk to you.
Well, sure. Yeah.
I wonder, is it more unique in quotes to the Park Service than the other agencies, other federal land agencies? I don't know.
I would say that because of the jurisdiction, principally. In a place like Yosemite, which had basically exclusive jurisdiction, you did not have the sheriff's office or the highway patrol or an outside fire department to help out. And that was one of the beauties, you know, from my perspective, one of the real, well, beauties, I guess is a good word, for living in a place like that is that you got in on everything. Now, some people don't like the infringement on their privacy, and, you know, when 5 o'clock rolls around and their shift is over, they're gone. And there's probably a little bit of that, but in Yosemite Valley in those days, that was not a very, that didn't happen very long. I mean, you know, the rangers particularly, which are the people I'm talking about mostly,
uh-huh.
You know, the rangers, you know, they were very willing. When they signed up, to be tough. That's what they were going to do. Was if they got called out at 4 o'clock in the morning because the fire alarm went off, that's what they did. And so in Yosemite, it might be worth noting that in the summertime, for bunches of years, I mean, I think pretty much the whole time I was there, for the summer months, we had a 24/7 operation in terms of somebody being on duty. Patrolman, and there's actually some fun historical ways that they accomplished this even before my time, because there actually were rangers doing stuff like this before me.
Mm-hmm.
And but we had a thing called MOP patrol, M-O-P, which I've always known as midnight on patrol, but I think there's actually another reason for that name, and frankly I can't conjure it up at the moment. So I'll leave it as midnight on patrol, but we'd have two or three at the very most, usually only two, rangers who'd be available, let's say, from, you know, midnight till 8, if that were the midnight shift. And so the dispatcher knew they could get hold of them for something, and generally they were, you know, by midnight or 2 o'clock, there'd be, you know, things had calmed down. There'd be an overlap. Often we'd have rangers, other rangers working from on the swing shift who might work until 1 or 2 o'clock. And so usually by that time in the morning, all the hooplaing and chaos and partying and all that sort of thing has sort of wrapped itself up.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys on MOP patrol could just sort of patrol the valley. They'd kick people out that were overnight camping where they weren't supposed to that sort of thing, go in and quiet down a party that was still too loud, perhaps. So, but the rest of the time, the other, you know, let's say 7 months to sort of define it, you know, so the other 7 months of the year, for the time I was there, I almost always did the scheduling. So I'd have people working till 1 o'clock, you know, a whole crew. There might be one person that's held over till 2, and then from 2 till, say, 6 in the morning, there'd be somebody on call. And it was the procedure, the SOP, that somebody the night before would put a patrol car with a handset radio, perhaps, in front of this person's house, and they'd put the keys on the front left tire or something. And when that ranger who was on call went to bed, and it might be somebody who actually had just been working until 1 o'clock anyway, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, if there was some reason, maybe a medical kind of a thing, because we did all the medical transports and stuff too, if there was some reason for, necessity, then the dispatcher would know to call that ranger.
Right.
And if that ranger might end up, depending on the situation, might end up having others call out to help out on a bad car wreck. I know that I've been out probably a dozen times for fatalities. You know, at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, somebody fall asleep driving into the park maybe or something.
Right.
And so there was the manpower that was available, but, you know, if you went out at 4 o'clock in the morning and you work for a couple of hours and the sun's starting to come up, and you might go home and try to catch an hour's sleep before you had to go back to work. And in my case, since I was the assistant Valley District Ranger, I had a lot of autonomy. And I unfortunately, in retrospect, would put myself in so that other people wouldn't have to be obligated or imposed upon. You know, and it wasn't like I was super altruistic. It was just that I could see the shortfalls in the scheduling, and I could tell that somebody was going to be maybe having to do a certain thing in the afternoon of the following day, and so I would say, okay, I will be the one on call, or I will be the one that will work late. So that had an impact on my family and my wife in particular. And I think I mentioned once before, my wife used to call the little handset radio, which, you know, we went from a 2-watt to a 5-watt radio, and which doesn't mean much to anybody except that the 5-watt was smaller, more powerful, and it was almost always on to a certain point. When we went to sleep, I would turn it off. But she would call it coitus interruptus.
Sure.
That was her way of saying, you know, that friggin' thing's on all the time, and you're listening to it more than you are to me.
Besides your wife, did anybody else, you know, like, try to give you a little heads up? Did anybody else see this happening to anyone else and you know, try to say something?
Well, if they did, Tom, I was oblivious to it. It didn't register.
Okay.
I'm not going to swear that there were a lot of people banging on my door telling me I was a total idiot.
No, but I mean, when you're a fish in the fishbowl, you don't necessarily see you're a fish in the fishbowl. Yeah. And it takes somebody kind of outside to look in and go, holy cow, you guys need to take care of yourselves and your relationships and your families, because this is consuming you.
Well, then there's another thing that, and it wasn't, you know, in retrospect, again, I have a lot of retrospects, right? In retrospect, my not drinking, which I think is a good thing personally, but I don't, it's not something I tell everybody else about. It's just something that I don't do. I just never acquired the taste for it. It tastes terrible.
Yep.
So, but, you know, my wife, who was a beautiful woman, she liked to party. And, you know, wasn't out there. She wasn't at every party with a lampshade on her head, but she liked to loosen up. And I wasn't that way. I was really pretty much I was pretty boring when it came to that sort of thing, actually. And, you know, sort of stoic, I guess. And so, you know, she ended up being attracted to a fellow ranger. And I won't get into any names or anything, but, you know, eventually a good friend of mine, and a good friend of hers for that matter, probably her best friend at that point anyway, recognized that this was going south.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, after this is all said and done, years later, we would talk. I talked to her on the phone a couple of days ago that she said, I knew this was, you know, this is happening. I mean, I knew that you were in trouble, that my wife, whose name Ann, was, you know, sort of sliding off into being attracted to this other guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that. And it wasn't really until we got to the Grand Canyon that this all hit the fan. So that's, again, another long answer to your question. I don't know that anybody really came up to me and said, you know, wake up and smell the flowers here, buddy, because, you know, things are happening. And I don't know how much I would have heard them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's hard to say. It's easy to kick myself while I'm down, but.
Well, this gets back to a message to the students, which is, this is real, this is dangerous, and you won't know it's going to clobber you until it's already happened.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing, because you set young kids up with adrenaline and lots of action, and that can be pretty seductive. It can also be pretty destructive.
Right. Well, no, you're 100% correct.
So you know how to. It's great. I think it's wonderful that you're actually, first off, telling this to these young kids. Be good. And things have changed now. There's different programs. I'm sure the agency has recognized this as a service-wide problem. I would like to think, but and try to figure out some good ways to deal with it.
Well, you know, just as a sort of a minor correction to what you said, and
Please.
you are terribly insightful. I mean, you've got a good handle on a lot of the stuff that's taking place.
Not like
reading
you.
between the lines. So I don't mean to correct you, but
Oh, please do.
trying to straighten the record out a teeny bit. But and this is probably not very, very important. But when I talk to these young people for 4 hours, you know, the very first thing I do, actually, the first thrust for the first 15 minutes is try to talk them out of becoming a park ranger.
Okay.
My job at that point is say, if you really, and this goes back to my old school flat hat, Smokey the Bear, friend to everybody kind of approach to park rangering, as opposed to being a sheer law enforcement ranger. I said, if you want to do 24/7 law enforcement, then go do it. But don't do it in the Park Service. You know, go become a sheriff's deputy. Go into the federal FBI. Go become a policeman someplace. And I said, I did it. And I did it for 3 years. So I got it out of my system in some ways. But if you think you're going to go into Wapatki or Saguaro or lots of other national park areas and think you're going to be doing 24/7 law enforcement, then you've got another thing coming. You're going to be frustrated, bored. Your job skills are going to deteriorate. There's all kinds of bad things. But, you know, and there are a couple exceptions to that. Yosemite Valley might be one of them. Lake Mead, Boulder Beach perhaps is one.
Right.
You know, a few places. But you're not going to do that at, Navajo National Monument. But what you are going to do is you're going to have a hell of a good job if you do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know, some SAR, some EMS, some resource management, some interpretation, some fire, as well as law enforcement. And if you think that's attractive because it's just a sort of a potpourri of different duties, all of which are interesting, and, you can roam around the backcountry sometimes. You can fly in helicopters and ride ATVs and horses, and you can hike and all kinds of that sort of thing. That's what makes the job so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you think you're going to be a policeman 24/7 in a smaller national park area, it ain't going to happen. So that's where I start off first, actually.
Okay.
You know?
Good. Good.
And I've had people give me feedback after that. I mean, I've over time, I've run into some of these people in various other national parks, you know, just traveling through. And you know, I wouldn't remember them, but they would remember me, and they'd bring that subject up. And I said, well, was there anything I said about anything that made any difference to you, you know? And surprisingly, implicitly, a number of them have said, yeah, actually, you know, when you talked about, the entirety of the job sorts of things, it made a big difference, you know?
Nice.
So, anyway,
good.
I didn't mean to
good.
Correct you. That was just...
No, please do. You got to jump right in there. Don't feel shy.
Minor asterisks to the conversation there.
Yeah. Because I think this is still a problem today, possibly, with short-staffed employees at parks whose visitation keeps going up and up and up. So I have to be kind of careful with that.
Well,
yeah.
I think I sort of shot my wad without getting too, not melodramatic, but morose about not paying attention to my wife and my family and my marriage. Responsibilities. I'm just hoping that the people understand that I think I screwed up. I don't think I was totally at fault, but I do think that I should have been much more there. And I don't know, unless you've got some questions about that, that there's much more I can really
No, thank you.
About kicking myself more.
Thank you for your candor and your willingness to entertain what is clearly something typically personal and people don't talk about, but is a real threat, I think, to agency personnel that can be consumed by their jobs. And that's an addiction, that adrenaline journey, and getting away from that or being able to detox from that. I'm not sure what the right word is. It takes some work. It's a very very difficult situation to try to navigate without having it damage you. The life with adrenaline.
Yeah. There's actually more to it than just adrenaline, per se. That was certainly a big part of it. But a lot of what I did was pretty mundane.
Okay.
And I don't know that we touched on as much as you wanted me to touch on it. But it was really a obligation to my job. I mean, I felt like I needed to do the best I could under, you know, whatever it was, training or organizing training or doing things on the job that should be done. But I wouldn't go home at night. This is sort of not the literal translation, but I wouldn't go home at night until I felt like, you know, things were under control as far as what I needed to be doing. So it was a commitment to my professional responsibilities, I think. And sometimes they got, you know, I went overboard, and that's part of the big problem. I would end up, you know, there'd be a weekend where I literally would have the days off, although I would have a radio with me. And, you know, I'd have a wife and two little kids at home. And rather than us packing up and going up to the high country and taking a picnic or something, you know, I had an opportunity to, say, make, some sort of a climb with some, good climbers. And I wasn't all that good a climber, but I wanted to learn a lot of it. And, I would choose to go do that. And I guess I just assumed that my wife understood. And I think she did for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, like, no, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, okay.
Yeah, interesting. And again, that's, I think it's the same in Death Valley and Lake Mead. You know, it's the attraction to go out and explore the resource is pretty strong.
Well, I've always contended when I teach at NAU, you know, rangers need to range. If you don't know what's out there to protect,
right?
How do you protect it?
Right.
And I know it sounds like an old. It sounds pretty simple, but
but
we don't do much.
But in your wife's defense, she might say, "Yeah, but you got to protect your family too. That's a part of the resource to be protected." And I think it's important to make sure that the future rangers hear that message.
Yeah, no, that's 100% correct.
Yeah. So how did your day-to-day mundane operations go? Speaking of those. This is an acting. No, you were acting chief ranger. You were. What was the description of your job?
Well, in Yosemite, I went there as a shift supervisor.
Shift supervisor. Okay.
That was from Death Valley, and then within the year, I think, because I went there in June of 71, June 21st, I think was my enter on duty date. June 21, 71. Roughly within the year, I was elevated a little bit to the Assistant Valley District Ranger.
Okay.
Which, you know, I guess sort of sounds important. But, I oversaw pretty much the day-to-day operations of, I don't know, 12 or 14 permanent rangers. And in the summertime, a whole bunch of seasonals. And my boss, the district ranger, was more into sort of the management, and you know he had the more final word on what was taking place. But again, I had a lot of autonomy. So I spent my, you know, the mundane part of the job might be me doing the schedule,
okay,
which could easily take 4 or 5 hours to fill out a schedule, because I was conscientious enough. I'd try to get a hold of people and say, well, now, do you want to go do this, or do you want to go to that training, or would you like to, you know, I can probably work it out since you get a 3-day weekend because you've been working your tail off uncompensatedly, you know, for the last week.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I'd want to touch bases with those people before I put them on the schedule. And, you know, same thing with finding out who I could rely on for being on call after, you know, the Rangers maybe had officially ended their shift. You know, and when I first got to Yosemite, sort of backing up real quickly, for 3 or 4 years, there are many, many, many days where, you know, I would be working at night and I wouldn't get home until the sun came up. I mean, that is literally true. I'd be walking up to my home trying to get there before I got too bright so I could try to go to sleep. We had, you know, our bedroom had the obligatory aluminum foil on the windows, you know, to block out the light, and had an air conditioner in the room that would drown out noises and stuff. So so the mundane part might be scheduling. That could take a fair amount of my day. There might be an issue with moving some small, you know, fee collecting booth out in the campground. So I'd be out there helping to supervise that or make recommendations. A lot of what I did was develop training. I really got caught up in this. I don't know that anybody else would recognize this, but I think I did a huge amount of extra training or organizing. It wasn't that I trained, but had got organized training of things that these guys would never be exposed to.
Okay.
And we did, you know, not too long into my time there, I became one of the captains, and then basically the first captain on the big fire truck. Yosemite had, the park had, in those days, had two structural fire trucks, and then the company had another structural fire truck. And I was the captain on the first, well, like the first captain, I guess, if you would say it that way. And the chief ranger and I would always try to beat the other one to the, when the fire alarm would go off. You know, we would race, we would race to get to the firehouse. And in my case, this is the honest to God truth. I had a Volkswagen van, 1973. And I lived at the top of this little hill, and it was really, if I were to walk it, it wouldn't take much more than, say, 5 minutes to get to the firehouse. But if I was on a bicycle or in my Volkswagen van, I could be there in 30 seconds.
Hmm.
And it was sort of downhill, and there were numerous times when the fire alarm would go off. Now, today, they have pagers and cell phones and things. But in those days, it was an audible fire alarm that sounded throughout the valley.
Okay.
There was no paging system. You did not get a radio thing. You just heard the fire alarm. And, you know, I'd have my Volkswagen pointed downhill, and there'd be a foot of snow on the ground, and I'd be running out there in my underwear, barefooted, getting in that Volkswagen van, and almost coast to the fire station so that I could be there before the chief ranger.
Trying to get your turnouts on to at least have some clothes to wear.
Well, I mean, I'd be running in there barefooted and jumping into my turnouts.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything was cold, but you didn't even think about that.
Right.
You know, because if the fire alarm went off at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, oftentimes there was a real reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
So just using fire as an example, if I knew that the Iwani Hotel, which is the big, I don't know if it's 5-star, but it's a, you know, it's a classic hotel in Yosemite or in the Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
If I knew that they were closed down for a month in December, because of renovations and retrofitting and whatever, we would schedule, and I would take upon myself to get hold of the officials and say, how about if we conduct a couple of days' worth of training here on the Ahwahnee Hotel? Of course, they understood the necessity for that and were very willing to cooperate. And but, you know, it just doesn't happen overnight and in a vacuum. There's a lot of coordination and touching bases with, you know, a variety of people about this. And so that was just a minor example. One training that I'm really proud of that was way ahead of its time is that I put together, and I say put together, I mean, I came up with a basic curriculum and I had a couple of experts help me, but on death investigation. It was a week-long school in Yosemite. It was open to other rangers throughout the West, or at least in the region that I belong to. And my real expert in the $64,000 booth, which is an old, whatever it is, you know, for people my age would remember that TV show.
Right.
But, you know, he was an FBI agent who was an attorney who had been working at the FBI, at Quantico, at the FBI Academy. But he was in Sacramento, and he was a very nice guy, and he loved the parks, and he was happy to help give me advice, and he's the one that had all of these bizarre death investigation kinds of scenarios and training.
Okay.
So I relied on him, but, you know, I structured it so that at the very end, for several hours, I'd have people who'd come in and talk about how to deal with the families and how to make death notifications and how to protect yourself, you know, the PTSD sorts of things. And it was a week long. It was 40 hours.
Okay.
And it was way ahead of its time. I don't know what they've done really much now, but this would have been in the late 70s. But, you know, we were having so many people die in Yosemite, and it wasn't that we could prevent them all. That wasn't the intent. It was really to figure out, so what happened here, you know, and how do we deal with this? And I mean, deal with it, you know, from a technical standpoint, because none of us had any training as a coroner, which I was. None of us had any training on a lot of things, you know, relative to all this trauma that was taking place around us.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it, I'm kind of sad that I don't have some of these curriculums that I designed or put together, or memos, you know, sent out to the other parks that actually identified some of the things that we did. But it was pretty much cutting edge.
Fun.
But, I mean, that's just sort of two examples of some of the mundane things that I did. They had a lot of importance, I think, and certainly in, you know, the climate of the Park Service in those days. But, you know, it could take a month to working on something like this intermittently to get everybody's schedules lined up and, you know, and then there, you know, the Park Medic Program, which I think we talked about.
We did. And I had a question too, and I think we talked briefly about this off recording, but I did want to kind of bring it back up. It seemed as though, well, this would have been about the time I think you were working for the Tucson Police Department, that employees of the Park Service, the interpretive rangers of today, would help in maintenance and would help in fee collection and would help in some resource management issues and would help in some law enforcement issues, just as the maintenance people would help in law enforcement or with search and rescue or would help in some resource management issues or would help in a little bit of interpretation. It seemed like the individual was at the park, but they could fill in for others or they could help in other areas outside of their specific job title.
Yeah, a lot of that has to do with the supervisor and the climate.
Okay.
You know, at the time.
And then it seemed as though that started to change and people became much more compartmentalized in their boxes. Now, I could be wrong on that. I'm not
I don't think you're necessarily wrong. I mean, it's, from my perspective, sadly, the Ranger, in some ways, the protection Ranger has turned into the law enforcement Ranger. And I think that horse is out of the barn, but that doesn't mean I can't whine about it. And it seems to me that what was so enjoyable and part of the really beauties of being a park ranger in my era and before was that you got to do a little bit of everything. But I'm afraid that a lot of these younger people think that law enforcement is the end all, and which I can't quite understand how people get really excited about giving somebody tickets for 20 years, for speeding. I mean, that just wasn't my thing, I suppose. So, Tom, I get off on these tangents and I have no idea where I'm going.
Well, no, this is fine, because this is something I've been kind of pondering the collegiality of the team and your ability, as you say, to get out of your box and to learn about a different part of the park, a different part of the aspect of how the Park Service works to protect these incredible resources versus the compartmentalization where I'm a law enforcement ranger and I don't do anything but this, that, and the other thing. And you need somebody to go do that. That's not me. Now, some of that I think I can understand just based on the demands of operating these parks are huge and personnel are small. So, if somebody needs some help, they're going to call out to another individual, but that individual is overrun doing what their other stuff is.
But, well, I think in a big park like Yosemite or Yellowstone or a Glacier kind of things, there is enough job demand within their own specialty that they don't need to be or don't want to be out doing other stuff. So,
but if somebody did, okay, so I'm the solid waste manager, and at the end of my shift, somebody else comes to replace me because this is a 24-hour deal that's going on here. Now I've got a lot of free time, though. I'm like, hey, I can go hang out with the climbers, or go hang out at the clinic, or go hang out in admin, or where else can I use my energy and my time to help out? And I just wonder if that's changing and happening less and less.
Well, I'm not so sure that was, in my experience, as prevalent as you make it seem.
Okay.
The one thing, there are a couple of, asides to this, is that particularly from the maintenance standpoint, a lot of them, and I'm not trying to be too general about this, I suppose, but many of them anyway, that was sort of an 8-to-5 job for them. And the exception to this might be some of these guys really did get into fire, into wildland fire, so that they understood their responsibilities and their interests and obligations, I guess, to helping out with, say, a wildland fire. But some of them did get into going to being on fire teams that would be set elsewhere. So that might be an exception to what you're talking about.
Okay.
None of them ever had any problem that I recall, actually, of being called out after hours to, to go take care of a broken pipe that's flooding a street or, that sort of thing. If it could be delayed until the next day, I think we try to do that. But I don't know that anybody bitched and moaned about it too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a lot of that. One of the beauties that I enjoyed at Wild Rose when I was in Death Valley is I actually did more maintenance work than I did any kind of protection. I other than roaming around and discovering stuff, I didn't really do that much law enforcement, but I did do a fair amount of minor maintenance around my part of the world there.
Well, it's funny, and I'll use that as an example. Were there any maintenance people that weren't doing much maintenance but were doing a lot more law enforcement? I mean, just, again, thinking about the, what's the word here, a sort of cross-pollination, if you will, of duties.
No, not really. But there were a few maintenance guys that, you know, showed an interest in, say, search and rescue.
Okay.
That ended up sort of defecting from the maintenance division. And, of course, they, you know, we knew of their interest. We knew that they had a skill that we needed. So some of them were converted and made into protection rangers. They actually went to, you know, later on in life, they went to law enforcement schools. So they ended up becoming that. But I don't know that they're technically from 1905, they had the legal authority to do law enforcement. I don't think I ever witnessed any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, even with the minimal training that we had in those days, you still get yourself in trouble.
Yeah.
And sure. I don't know that it was something that a lot of them wanted to bite off and chew. Now, one good example about this cross-pollination is that I have a very dear friend who I still know very well and keep in touch with. Larry Frederick is his name, and he retired as the... he's the chief of interp at Rocky Mountain with some details where he was the acting superintendent of various places like Wind Cave, I think. But when I worked with him in Yosemite, in Grand Canyon, he was an interpreter. He was like a district interpreter or something. But he was also a full paramedic.
Okay.
And, you know, he had an interest, and he went out and got the credentials. He did it all on his own time. Traveled back and forth to Flagstaff and Phoenix to get this training because he was interested in it. Well, you know, I mean, I knew this, at my job as the assistant chief ranger at Grand Canyon with search and rescue and EMS as a responsibility, you know, and so he'd be the first person on my Rolodex to, Larry, can you go? Generally he had enough autonomy for himself that he could go. So there was a little bit of that, but reflecting back on your original premise, it wasn't as much cross-pollination as you're, I think, leading us to believe.
Well, I guess my question is, when it was happening, is it still happening as much today or not? And that's, you know, you've been retired for a little while, but I think you're still got a good, pretty good pulse of what's going on. You mentioned someone like Larry, who's in interp, but helps in the search and rescue with his medical skills. I'd like to think that that's still happening today, but I don't know.
Well, I don't have a finite answer for you. I guess my sense is no. I mean, I guess I would like it to see more of it, but I didn't see that much of it really. You know, during my era either.
Okay.
So I'm not so sure that there's that much of it. And a place like Yosemite and some of the bigger parks, the job demand and the visitation has doubled since I was in Yosemite, that you just sort of don't have time to do some of this, even though you might like to.
Right.
If you were a maintenance man and were on the road crew, you know, you were... You know, 8 hours of your day was out there doing whatever you do on a road crew, and you were probably way behind the power curve in terms of getting it done to begin with.
Right.
So I don't know that you did too much of that after hours. I do know that I'm sure that there were occasions when, particularly when you live in the more of the isolated outreaches of Yosemite, which is when I got out of Yosemite, I was the Mather District Ranger, which meant I lived in a little small, six or seven family little enclave that was roughly an hour's drive from Yosemite Valley. You know, you sort of relied on people then, particularly when it came to a medical emergency. You could get one of the maintenance men to come out and help flag traffic at a car wreck or something like that.
Right.
And so there was that. But I think in today's world with lesser staffing, relatively speaking, lesser budgeting and lesser but greater, like, twofold at least, visitation. I don't think they have the opportunity to do that much cross-pollination.
All right. As a Assistant Valley District Ranger, did you do payroll?
No. Okay. No.
So someone else did that?
Yeah. Well, we had a, our secretary.
Okay.
That was part of her job, part of her mundane job. She would, and it was always a she at this point. I don't know if they've got males now, but at that point, she was the secretary district, Valley District.
Okay.
And each of these places had their own people like that, a little admin person, if you will.
Okay.
And they, of course, they answered for some of their job standards to others further up that had more experience and, or at least more authority. So, no, the answer is no. I can't remember if I would tell her who had worked or something. Maybe in terms of overtime, we're going to submit John Doe for 6 hours
okay.
for a rescue and, make sure that's reflected in their pay thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
No, I don't, I you would not want me as a pay person.
So doing the scheduling, employee schedule, work schedule, training, what other some of the mundane things were you doing?
Well, if they were really high in my memory, I'd remember. Right? let me think about this. I think, as a supervisor, you want to go out and just sort of let people know you love them by visiting with them
okay.
and seeing them at work and maybe working alongside them. I really enjoyed, which I don't think we do enough of these days, really enjoy. I go into the visitor center and I wouldn't be working with my people that I supervised, but I thought it was important and would be fun and interesting to work there at the front desk. What do people have to, what are they asking? And a lot of them just want to know where the bathroom is, of course.
Right.
But, there was a way that I could contribute and I'd get to know other staff members that weren't necessarily part of my little domain.
Right. It's a great way to get to know the interp folks who are dealing with that same where's the bathroom question 8 hours a day, every day. Yeah.
Well, no, and I always thought that was important.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I'm not sure that you remember, I'm not even sure if I remember telling you about breaking my wrist jumping a horse.
No.
Because I oversaw for a number of years, part of what I did was oversee the horse patrol too as the Assistant Valley District Ranger. We had, and this has been sort of intermittent over the years, but in the late 60s, they developed a pretty classy horse patrol with all matched Morgan horses that were well-trained, super well-trained, to the point where they have been working around the presidents of the United States. They were in the Rose Bowl parade several times. They were pretty well respected.
There was a ranger at Grand Canyon named Ken Hulick.
Yeah.
And Hulick had a Tennessee Walker, and he would ride that horse to Phantom Ranch. The horse patrol, the horse presence is a really beautiful thing, fascinating thing. Long heritage of that.
Yeah, well, Ken was a good friend of mine when I moved to Tucson. He helped me sort of get organized.
Okay.
I mean, back into retirement, for one thing. But so the story about me going to visit this work unit, there were, I think there were 8 rangers, seasonal rangers, and 1 permanent on this horse patrol. And they were there, most of them were school teachers, and so at the end of the season, they'd be off teaching school. But what we would do, what they would do is one day a week, they'd spend 3 or 4 hours together as a unit. And the guy that was the wrangler, who was an old school cowboy who knew a lot about horses and knew a lot about how to get the best out of the horse and match it with the rider and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be there and he'd put these guys through sort of skills, you know, some, doing just riding skills and, put all the visqueen down on the ground and let the horses run through it, make sure that the horse is under control and little minor firecracker kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And jumping. So, which leads me to this little tiny story, which is that I went over to watch these guys work out one afternoon. And of course, I was cocky enough, knowing that I spent a lot of time on horseback and had my own quarter horse for a while. You know, and I thought I was God's gift to riding. But I'd really never done much jumping, certainly never in an organized, formal way. And these guys were, they routinely would use 3-foot, poles. And, we had the little standards that you put the poles on and stuff, and,
mm-hmm.
Regular thing. So I get over there, and they're jumping, and he doesn't like me anyway. But he says, Butch, do you want to try this? Well, of course, I'm not going to let that pass. And I knew absolutely zero about really what to do. But he put me on, one of the Cadillacs of the horses, whose name I've forgotten, but one of these legendary, beautiful patrol horses we had. And he says, okay, this is what you do, And he described to me of, once you get close to the bar, give it its head and
mm-hmm.
Do a little kick in the side, a little flank kick stuff, and the horse will do all the rest of it. Okay, well, what could go wrong?
That sounds easy?
Yeah, that sounded pretty easy, So I'm doing this. Of course, I got, 6 or 8 seasonal rangers watching me and this other guy. And we get up to the bar, and the horse balks. I haven't been controlling it quite properly, apparently. And he gets up to this bar and stops. He sort of slides in, because I'm not at a full gallop, but I'm moving pretty fast.
And I'm assuming you're leaning forward.
Well, yeah.
Maybe.
But probably not correctly.
Okay.
So we get up to this bar, and the horse comes to a 99% stop. And I lean back and sit back into the saddle thinking, well, okay, we got to go around and try this again.
Okay.
Well, as soon as I lean back, I don't know what happens, but the horse jumps over this thing sideways.
Wow.
I mean, sort of crow foots over. I'm not sure if that's even a real term, but... He just sort of leaps sideways and clears this bar.
Okay.
Well, I'm not prepared for that. I'm not in the saddle well enough. I'm not even holding on to the horn. And the next thing I know, I'm flying through the air. And I land on my hands.
Okay.
And I've already got one broken wrist from a high bar from when I was 17, rather. And so I end up, hitting the ground, and I'm not sure at this point how much damage I've done, but I'm not going to let anybody know that I've been damaged.
Oh.
So, okay, so I, and I think we probably explained, we talked about it for probably a minute or two, how did you not do this correctly?
Right.
And I probably demurred off, I don't know, but, said, well, okay, I got to go back to work or something.
Right.
Just so that I wouldn't have to try that again. And now, in fairness, I've learned to jump a lot since. But
nice.
But at that point, I knew zip. And as it turns out, I'd broken my wrist.
Hmm.
Of course, I didn't get it set. Didn't go to the hospital for...
You didn't go to the clinic right down the road?
No, I didn't know.
Okay.
Maybe I wrapped it. But, I lived with it. And to this day, both my wrists are... They're not 100% screwed. They're just... I have no strength in either one of my wrists. So, I don't know how mundane that was, but it had to do with visiting and working with and letting, the people that I worked with and for know that I was willing to get out there and get my hands dirty as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was sort of a mundane thing that I did, which I think is a good trade of a supervisor, to get out and let people see you and work with you and figure out who the heck you are, you know.
Right, right.
I don't know if that answers your mundane question at all. But.
No, I agree with that. I think it's very important. And it helps build teamwork and you know, face recognition, especially in a large park where there's lots of employees. And you know, the people in this department might not necessarily know who's working in that department.
Well, yeah. Now, you know, from a ranger standpoint, a protection standpoint, a Valley District standpoint, it was sort of a closed community.
Hmm.
I've got, I don't know, 5 or 6 class photos, I guess, if you will. Of, you know, you have the obligatory, everybody get together and have their photo taken.
Right.
Which was generally when we would have seasonal training, because most people would be on and they'd be around and they wouldn't have other commitments. And, you know, that was one of the mundane things I did too, was coordinating these, you know, we're going to have this class photo.
Okay.
For lack of a better term.
Yeah.
You know, in the meadow at 2 o'clock, and be there in uniform and get your flat hat on and make sure that if you're there, and if you're not, then tough.
And
you're not going to be in that photo.
How would you get the camera up in the air to get the picture of everybody?
Oh, well,
there?
No, it wouldn't be quite that fancy.
Okay.
It would be, you know, we'd get somebody that knew what they were doing with a camera, you know, generally one of the interpreters.
Right.
And the park actually, at least for the summer times, often, the first years that I was there, actually had I think they were getting paid, but they're sort of like interns too, where they would they'd go around and take photos of stuff.
Hmm, okay.
So there was some of that, but in this case, no.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, somebody might be standing on a chair.
No APS guy with the picker truck.
No.
And a bucket putting somebody way up in there with a camera to, you know.
I've done that, but that was at the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, no, it's very, very common at the Grand Canyon to get that picture and get all the vehicles out there and everybody dressed out in there.
Plus, you got the canyon in the background.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
what,
right.
What wouldn't be good about that, right?
Exactly, exactly. It's really, really nice. So
there are a lot of mundane kinds of stuff, and I'm sort of scrambling to try to find, think of other mundane things I did. But there was a lot of day-to-day stuff. It wasn't always wall-to-wall
right.
Adrenaline.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. Thank heavens.
Yeah.
Catch your breath.
Yeah, I suppose that's right.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, you sort of forget the mundane stuff, and all you remember is the adrenaline.
Right, right. Well, once again, it's 1:17 in here. is there anything else you'd like to bring into this?
Oh,
to this part that we haven't covered.
No, I thought the most important thing is to be on record to say, you know, that. You know, from a relationship standpoint, I am not the poster child on this deal. You know, there are a lot of things that I did wrong. I mean, I wasn't always bad, but I could have been much better. And, you know, who knows how divorces last or marriages last or don't last. Park Service, unfortunately, I've always had this thing in the back of my mind, and I voiced this numerous times. So this is not novel. But I always thought it'd be kind of an interesting study in sociology to have this big wall with somebody with a magic wand that could put on this wall all of these relationships and marriages and the incestuous, you know, if you're not married to that person now, you will be in 3 years kinds of diagrams to see what had happened. And I don't know that we're any different than any other police agency or maybe even the military.
Mm.
You know, perhaps fire departments, you know, places where people are under a lot of stress for various reasons.
Right.
But it always seemed to me that the Park Service, certainly Yosemite, had more than its share statistically of marriages that went wrong. And it might be they weren't strong enough to begin with. I mean, I've never gone into that kind of detail, but I do know that we had a lot of problems, you know, as an agency, I think in general. But I wouldn't stand here in front of everybody and say that we're any worse than any other
mm-hmm.
group like that. But it was a lot.
No, I would think any agency that has high demands, high stresses, lots of activity, and is short of staff, is going to have this. And in the defense of the four of you, you know, your two sons and the woman who reared your children. I think all four of you did fairly well, especially looking where your sons are now.
Yeah. No, I'm pleased about that.
Yeah. So the world is full of what we should have done and could have done, but here we are. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. You know, that's. Well, I'll tell you some stuff after you turn this thing off.
Okay. And with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 10 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Butch Farabee. Today is Sunday, June 21, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Butch, thank you so very much.
Well, I guess it's my pleasure, Tom. I don't know.
Hang in there.
We'll see.